One, two, three. Maybe you got your head caught in a ditch last night.
Join us the evening of Friday, September 25th for a live acoustic performance by the artist Waxahachie at the Memorial Chapel on the Wesleyan University campus.
This event is presented by WESU in association with the Wesleyan Office of Student Activities and Leadership Development.
Tickets will be on sale for $15 through the Wesleyan University box office, but also accessible at WESUFM.org.
A portion of the proceeds will go directly to WESU.
So come support your favorite community radio station and enjoy a great show.
Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new contemporary lifestyle radio show for women over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. You're listening to WESU Middletown. Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of For Women Over 40. I'm so glad you could join us. Today I'll be talking to two women about mothers and new mothers in the workplace. We'll be finding out where mothering policy stands in this country, where we need to work harder to make some changes, and where we've come in the last 20, 30 years. Lori Mihalik-Levin is the founder of Mindful Return and the creator of the Mindful Return e-course. Mindful Return's mission is to create a supportive community of mamas returning to work after maternity leave who want to feel present, both with their babies and in their careers. A healthcare lawyer, she is also mama to two beautiful redheaded boys ages 2 and 4. Lori holds a law degree from the Georgetown University Law Center and completed her undergraduate studies at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Valerie Young is a public policy analyst who represents Momentum, an organization which empowers and educates women in Washington, D.C. She is an advocate for recognition of mothers' contributions to our national welfare and a proponent of economic security and independence for those who care for family members. Valerie educates policymakers who work on issues pertinent to women. She also advises members on developments in the political arena, encouraging the personal activism of mothers and other family caregivers. She is the author of Momentum, Advocacy, E-News, and blogs weekly at Your WOMAN in Washington. Her work also appears in the Shriver Report, Brainchild Magazine, and is frequently featured on blogher.com. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us, Sima.
So it's not a new phenomenon to have women working outside the home, but can you give me a little sense of history? Tell us where we are today in the United States and what are some of the trends going on pushing forward into the 21st century?
It started off, if we go back to the agrarian or agricultural society, the family was sort of a single economic unit, and all adults and even some children participated in its security and success. With the Industrial Revolution, the workplace and the home became separated. And for a great many families, we rather fell into a paradigm of the male, the father, would go to a workplace somewhere outside the home. And mothers were traditionally assigned the caregiving duties and responsibilities inside the home. There was one big blip where this rather changed, which was during World War II, when women flooded the workforce to be meaningful contributors to the war effort and did a lot of industrial and factory jobs related to that. At that point, we had a fabulous child care system. But then when the war ended, it was generally understood that the men would come back and resume all the paid jobs, and women would shift and go back home and do the uncompensated household labor. Starting in 1960, 1970, women's labor force participation rates were just under half, but then in the 70s through the 80s, they went over 50%. Since the 1990s, though, we've sort of maxed out at around 60-65%, And now we have been essentially flat for the past 20, 25 years, which means women's labor force participation rates are not increasing. And this is kind of an anomaly because women's education has been increasing tremendously. Women now get more degrees than men do at every level, high school, undergrad, master's, and doctoral. So you have this kind of weird situation where even though women are the more educated gender, and even though some forms of gender discrimination have decreased, you don't see that reflected in an uptick in women's labor force participation. That suggests to me that because of our policy situation, women are not participating to the extent that they could.
Lori?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this not as a historic perspective, but I'm looking at the snapshot as I'm in that generation of women who are having kids right now and going back to work. And what I see with some of the younger generations is a desire to plan for flexibility. So plan that women will move toward a more flexible schedule whenever they go back, or take a crazy hour job when they're fresh out of college, but then decide that they will move to another job even before they have a kid that will allow them some greater flexibility. So I think women are looking at this as not an all or nothing proposition, that they want to be able to do both, be great employees and be great moms, and they're trying to figure out a way to navigate the two at the same time.
I think that'll be one of the conundrums for the 21st century. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Including some stats here, could you give me some about what percentage of women now work outside the home? What was it a generation ago? And what do you think has caused the changes? You would attribute that split.
Looking at the data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, I see a pretty consistent 60% rate for women from 1995 on, and it really hasn't changed that much. Intriguingly, the labor force participation rate for mothers is actually higher at 70%. That, of course, is dealing with a smaller age cohort. It goes from about 24 until about 54. So it's not unusual that it should not track all women. And it suggests to me that economic imperatives are really compelling younger women, those with children, to be more engaged in the labor force. The fact that women overall are flat at 60%, you have to assume that a number of those women are older and would naturally not be in the labor force because they're over 65 or 70.
But to that aim, you wouldn't think that the stats wouldn't include it, given that so many people in their older years are making that choice to continue working, no?
Yeah, we're working longer. But, I mean, I'm looking at the graphs, and the labor force participation rates have really stayed remarkably flat.
Hmm. And how does this compare to other countries?
Every other developed and industrialized nation has a paid maternity leave policy. Also, every other industrialized and developed nation has a higher participation rate for women, which is another piece of information which makes me think it's at least in part due to our policy scenario that women's labor force participation in the United States is not as high.
And what would be some of the reasons for that?
Well, this is a very complicated question. There's definitely more than one answer, and not everybody agrees on what the relative or the relevant factors are. I think in the United States, we have a sense that families and individuals make or break their own destiny. And we don't see the government so much as playing a role in the structure of the workplace. We leave that to private enterprise, to businesses. And the United States is much more a pro-business country in its political philosophy than it is a pro-family country. So I think because our laws prefer freedom in the business realm, when you have a whole gender, a whole group of people that are paid less and are regarded because of their traditional caretaking association, and that would be women, they're not going to be equally competitive in the labor market, and they're not going to be equally situated with men in the labor market.
So if you could have a crystal ball and you could affect some change, what would be that first goal you would have in mind for this country?
I think the most important thing to do would be to equalize caring obligations between the genders and separate that link of women still being the majority of family care providers.
How would you do that in the workplace?
I think we'd have to have laws. I think the government has got to act because the market does not provide things like childcare in the quantity and at a price range that we need. The market does not provide the kind of flexibility in work that is required for people who have multiple obligations in addition to earning a living. The market does not provide the kind of opportunities based on merit alone. I think people in the upper echelons of power tend to hire and promote people that resemble them. So you still see a tremendous disproportionate number of men in the highest positions. And even with women's education, this natural, organic trajectory towards equality is not happening. And so that makes me think that we really need to move on the policy level and have things like paid sick days, paid family medical leave, paid maternity and paternity leave, to share the caregiving burden across the different members of society.
This is Lori. I was just going to jump in and say, I think what you said is incredibly important about sharing the caregiving responsibilities. And I think that starts from the very, very beginning of a baby's life, right? So whatever we can do to destigmatize paternity leave, I think is incredibly important in moving us in that direction. Because right now, even when companies offer paid paternity leave, they're often the men are looked down upon for taking it and viewed as not as committed to the workplace. And that imbalance of responsibility falling on the mom can start from day one of the baby's life. And so to the extent we can get fathers engaged in their children's upbringing from day one and allow them to participate actively for the first couple of months of the baby's life, I think you start off on a better foot.
So there's always that discussion in a home about the value that a stay-at-home mom provides to the family versus the father who goes to work. Not always, but usually. And so there have been many discussions about how do you quantify value when you're not actually getting paid by an external organization. Do you ever look at the value that the stay-at-home mom or dad provides, and what would be a measurement of that value?
It's approached several ways. One way is to add up what it would cost to get those services that the caregiving parent provides on the market. But, of course, this would result in a pretty low figure, or a relatively low figure, because as a society, we don't pay very much for child care providers. We don't pay very much for people who cook and clean and drive cars. So you get a number for the replacement cost of those services, but it's going to carry with it sort of the stigma that we have against caregiving work or caregiving activity. Another way to do it is called opportunity cost to the family caregiver. If that person came out of a field as, say, law or any kind of job, you look at what they were paid, and then that's the opportunity cost of providing those services. If that person comes out of the paid workforce, then their particular number would be what they were paid when they were in the labor force. So that's another way of doing it. And there's a third way, which I think is really much more important, and it makes sort of the points that I feel are really relevant, and that is to look at the economic value that the country gets when these children are raised well, have the kinds of interactions that develop what we call the soft skills, like honesty, sharing, cooperation, the ability to follow instructions, the ability to solve problems, settle conflict. Those sorts of things are really the direct result of what happens in the very earliest years, and it's generally the mother or a early education teacher or a child care provider who's influencing those things. It has been estimated that in the United States, if you added up the economic value of all that, it would be somewhere between 21 and 50% of our entire nation's GDP. If the nation's GDP, I think the latest figure was for 2013, and I think it was $17 trillion. So if you take just a third of that, that's between $5 and $6 trillion. So I think you could say that the mothers of America, or if you wanted to be more general, the primary family caregivers of America are responsible for generating services whose economic value is reasonably and conservatively estimated at $7 trillion. And that's a significant number.
You know, it's a fascinating discussion. And before we move on, I'd like to talk about new moms in the workplace. I'm wondering if there's a country that you wish we would emulate. Is there any country that has it right?
Many countries do track what they call satellite accounts, and that is the economic value of these unpaid domestic labor and services provided in the home. The two countries that pop most readily into my mind are Switzerland and Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that anybody is paid for the work. It's not that it goes into what figuring out what your Social Security benefit or your pension would be, but they do track and account for the value of this unpaid domestic labor. And I think even though that doesn't result in an income to the family caregiver, it's incredibly significant in acknowledging that that unpaid work has everything to do with the well-being of the people in the country, the strength of their economy, the resilience of the nation, and their ability to compete on a global level. And going forward, you want to position the U.S. to be competitive in the global marketplace, and you want to ensure our national security. And both of those things have everything to do with the care that is provided.
So it makes me think of it takes a village to make a community, and maybe in some ways we in the United States kind of lack some of that moxie, some of that initiative, correct?
That's right, but I don't know if it's a lack of initiative. I think the deal with the U.S. is that we are so individualistic, and we came along as a country as if we're out there all the Marlboro men, and we're unrolling our bedroll under the stars, and we make our own destiny, and everything that we have is the result of our own success. And so it's just sort of this idea that we are all individuals rather than we have a collective well-being, and that we are all going to be better off if we all protect and promote each other's well-being.
Sure. So, Lori, let's talk a little bit about new moms in the workplace.
Sure.
What are some of the biggest concerns new mothers face when they're planning and returning from maternity leave?
Yeah, the list is very long of the things that new moms are concerned about. And I guess some of the things that come to mind that a lot of women are struggling with include transitioning caregiving to someone who they may believe is competent, but they don't know the person. Finding time in their own day to take care of themselves is something that women struggle with because there doesn't seem to be a single spare moment. And, you know, you're getting up multiple times at night, so nobody's sleeping, and you're trying to, you know, show up at work and transition a baby to childcare. People struggle with their responsibilities upon returning to work in terms of what was done while I was gone and where do I pick up as I return? Do I need to kind of catch up on everything I missed? Can I step into a new role upon my return, or what is my place upon my return to work? They struggle with negotiating flexible schedules and figuring out what is a schedule that's going to work for them so that they get to see their child and so that they get to contribute meaningfully to the workplace. And they struggle with feeling lonely and not feeling like they have time to connect with other women who are going through the same experience at the same time, because everything is spinning so fast that they're just trying to get their head around what's going on in a given day. So those are some of the top few items, but there are many more concerns that women are worried about as they're returning.
So you're talking about flexibility, and I'm wondering how important it is in making working outside the home possible for mothers. And in terms of flexibility moving into the 21st century, how are companies seeking ways to accommodate the new workplace, if you might?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think flexibility is incredibly important in being able to retain top talent. And of course, there are some jobs that are more flexible than others that make the return all the more easy. To the extent that you're able to eliminate a commute one or two days a week by working from home allows you to spend more time with your child and just kind of get more done in your life and feel like you can manage more things. And to the extent that you can adjust your hours, I've heard it referred to as the split shift, where, you know, a working mom goes into work at the normal time in the morning, leaves at 4:30 or whatever to go home and get their child from daycare, which is about to close, puts the child to bed, and then goes back on and works the rest of their day at night after the baby's asleep. It's something I definitely experienced myself. So I think to the extent employers are willing to be flexible in terms of the days and times, and as long as the work gets done, the FaceTime component doesn't have to be there, I think that's incredibly helpful for new mothers. And one tip that I give new moms, right, what I encourage them to do as they're pregnant and thinking about their maternity leave and their return is to talk to their employer about whether or not there's a trial period during which they could give a more flexible schedule a whirl and just see if, say, for the first 2 months after coming back, whether they can have 2 days a week with their telecommuting or whatever arrangement they come up with. And so then their employer gets to realize that there's a trial period, they'll see how it works, they don't have to commit to something permanent, and it might make them more likely to agree to something that is perhaps out of the norm for their office. But it's, I think, something that's evolving over time and that more and more workplaces are getting used to the idea around creating more flexibility for working parents and just employees in general who are interested in having that work-life balance.
We're talking today to two women about mothers and new mothers in the workplace, the complexity of moving into the 21st century, and a little bit about public policy as well. We're talking to Lori Mihalik-Levin and Valerie Young. So how can a mother negotiate a flexible work arrangement during pregnancy, as you've said? And I think one thing that needs to be addressed is fear. I think that the fear of the unknown, you might do everything in your power to make a flexible work arrangement which works for you, but you may not have handled pregnancy healthily as you had hoped. You might be out longer than you had planned. And again, this all leads to uncertain futures, correct?
Absolutely. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of guilt. There's I don't know what I can ask for going on. And so one of the things that I've tried to do in working with women who are pregnant and who are on maternity leave is to give them the confidence to make an ask, to really think hard about what they think would be a situation that would help them, and then to dare to ask for it. And, you know, even if there isn't someone else in their office who is doing something similar, to see if it is, in fact, a reasonable possibility. I encourage women to talk to other folks in their workplace who may have flexible schedules or have tried things to figure out the lay of the land before they go in there to talk to their supervisor or their boss or HR. But then, and on some level, to be daring. And then ultimately, if you wind up in a situation that doesn't work and your employer isn't willing to be flexible and it's really not working for you, then maybe it's time to look for another employer who is willing to be flexible. And I think it's the fact that women are leaving to find places that are more accommodating that are causing employers to start reconsidering, you know, what is normal and what is acceptable in the workplace.
And to that aim, has your research or investigation shown you that larger corporations are appearing to be more flexible and more willing to give in this regard, or much smaller companies, or is it difficult to make an assumption?
I don't think you can stereotype quite that way. I think what I've discovered in all the women who I've worked with is that it really depends on some level on who you're working for, you know, who your boss is and who the management is and whether they seem to understand the conundrums of juggling family and work and know and believe that you are committed deeply to both. I think there are small companies that are really great at this and there are really big companies that are great at this. And more companies are trying to make strides in this area and are touting themselves as, you know, wanting to retain women. And so I'm hopeful that we're moving in a good direction across the board.
It occurs to me, though, that in this discussion, we have to be speaking primarily about white-collar workers. It occurs to me that I just don't imagine the flexibility would be there for more blue-collar jobs. Is that would that be a good assumption?
Yeah, I think absolutely. There are some jobs that simply, the jobs themselves by their very nature do not afford them the flexibility. And I recognize that I'm speaking from a perspective of women who are white collar workers. I have a friend and colleague, Kira McNett, who runs a nonprofit called the First Shift Justice Project that works specifically with hourly wage working women who are facing pregnancy discrimination and don't even know what their rights are when they get pregnant. And so I think she and others like her are working to help women who are not in the white collar jobs to know what their rights are and know that they do have rights and that they are entitled to accommodations, especially, you know, while they're pregnant and upon their return.
Assuming that the mere act of pregnancy and of having a child really does fundamentally change a woman and obviously a man as well, I'm wondering what skills can be gained and brought back into the workplace just by nature of the experiences?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very glad you asked that question. It's something that I really encourage women to do, is to talk about the skills that they are gaining as a mother and how those skills are applicable in the workplace. I have, you know, a laundry list of ways that I believe women become more skillful in lots of different areas, and some of those are in anticipating the needs of stakeholders. I mean, little babies are certainly demanding customers, and you're better able to predict in advance what someone like your boss or your customer might need. Prioritization is a huge one. Before I got pregnant, I definitely thought that everything could be crossed off of a to-do list, and now I recognize that to-do lists are aspirational, and what is at the very top of the list is the most important. So I think in motherhood, you learn exactly what is the most important and what is the highest priority, and you act on that. I think patience and adaptability are big virtues that parents grow. It seems nothing happens according to plan when you become a parent, and I think in the workplace that's all the more important, that you can be nimble and adjust to a variety of environments. I think women grow, moms in particular, grow in their delegation skills out of absolute necessity when they become parents, and that can be super helpful back at your job, where you're feeling more confident in delegating to others and not feeling like you have to have control over everything all the time, because you just simply don't have the bandwidth. One piece of advice that I always give to new moms is to try and build into your goals for the year that you are pregnant, and to build into your annual review that you're going to be judged on, all the work that you've done in planning for and preparing for your leave and return, so that you're able to get credit for the effort that you've put into it, so that people, you know, don't automatically think, oh, well, you were gone for a few months, you don't deserve that raise or promotion or whatever. No, you did hard work to be able to leave and have everything run smoothly while you were gone. And so I think women who are going on a maternity leave and coming back should be asking for credit for the effort that they're putting in.
Sima, can I say something about that question? The aspect I wanted to interject in the conversation is that I think this, mothers have a reputation, a stereotype of being less committed, less competent, and less capable, and that's called the motherhood penalty. I think in actual fact, though, the reality is extremely different. Mothers, in my mind, are natural managers. Mothers constantly have to deal with limited resources, be it time, money, whatever assets they have. They have to deal with multiple demands, sometimes conflicting demands, and they have to try to get most of the people in their family, most of what they want, most of the time. And so constantly having to make judgments and decisions about how you're going to allocate your resources to get the maximum benefit is a tremendous skill, and I think it should be very highly valued in the workplace. And in order for that to happen, women and mothers have to value it in themselves first.
So, Valerie, what one thought would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I'd like to point out that the changes that we desperately need, which is a cultural value on care, to see it as part of the primary work of a country, part of the primary work of a community, and part of the primary goal of any economic plan, is the care that has to happen, because it is related in the foundation to all of these other efforts. Women are not going to get any more power and be in more influential positions without a concerted effort. It's not going to happen organically and on its own. If we were going to get to equality just by our experience in the workplace and our education, it would have happened decades ago.
And Lori?
Yeah, I think while great policy changes need to happen, and while we're working toward them and waiting for them to happen, there are a lot of ways that women can support one another, especially in big life transitions like having a child. And I think it's absolutely critical that women come together, learn from one another through these experiences, so that they can feel more empowered as they go back to be committed both to their children and to their workplaces.
We've been talking today with two really fascinating women about the state of motherhood and working moms in the United States. Lori Mihalik-Levin can be found at www.mindfulreturn.com. Valerie Young at www.mom-mentum.org. I want to thank the two of you. We could have spoken for another hour. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Days, weeks even.
Absolutely. But we will make some changes. I thank you very much for joining us. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. You're listening to WESU Middletown, 88.1 FM on your dial. And until next time,